All right. Welcome back. Everybody survived their first project deadline? Yes? You all look alive. That's good. I had a few questions about the final project reports. Those are always due one day after the code deadline, so just so you know that. So if you happen to use slip days on a project, then your report's due the day after you turn it in. So that's kind of how that works. So, all right. So last time we were talking about deadlock, and we're going to finish up deadlock today about about a third of the way through the lecture, and then we're going to move on to something else. But one thing we talked about was the banker's algorithm, which basically is difficult the first time you see it. So that's fine. But the bottom line here is that you imagine that there's a banker whose job it is to watch the withdrawal of resources. And the idea is they're never going to let more resources be taken out or locked up than will allow the system to complete. Okay, so the way to look at this, another way to look at this is we showed you how to detect if the system was in deadlock. Right, we gave you a deadlock detection algorithm. And all we do is we use that algorithm, and for every request, the banker says, well, let's assume you got that request. Let's run the deadlock detection algorithm. If we gave you that request, would we be locked up in deadlock? If so, okay, you can't have those resources yet. That's a simple idea. Okay, so even though it seems complicated, it's very simple. It's sort of a thought experiment. If we imagine giving you resources, would we have the potential for deadlock? And that's why we use the deadlock detection algorithm, essentially just inserting this expression here, max node minus alloc node less than avail for request node less than avail. This was what we said in the deadlock detection algorithm, which was kind of a point in time looking at what everybody requests. This just says, let's assume that you're going to end up requesting what you don't have yet of your maximum, and we're going to use that to see why whether we're in deadlock or not. That's all it is. It's a direct substitution. Okay? And if you actually look at the description of this in the book, they talk about keeping the system in a safe state. And a safe state simply says that the current state of the system, if we were to imagine looking at the current state, we could find an ordering of all the threads there such that if you sort of finish thread 1, thread 2, thread 3, thread 4, eventually everybody will finish. That's a safe state. And the banker's algorithm keeps everything safe. Basically, you never leave a safe state. Okay? Were there any other questions on that? Does that make sense to everybody? It's kind of never leave a safe state. Never hand out resources that would possibly deadlock the system. Yeah.
Does it mean every time you acquire a lock, you have to run this algorithm?
Yes. Every time you go to acquire a resource, you have to run this algorithm. Every time you release a resource, you sort of have to run part of this algorithm to put that resource back in the set of available resources. So you can see how this could be expensive, right? But it does prevent deadlock. And you and your clever algorithmic minds can probably figure out ways of caching the right state so that each run of an allocation request doesn't have to redo the whole graph traversal. Okay, so there are ways to make this fast. All right, we good on the banker's algorithm? Go ahead. That's a great question. So it seems that if you refuse to give resources to a thread, you're holding that thread up. Therefore, aren't you causing potential for deadlock? Great question. The answer is no. And the reason is that we're holding the thread up before we get into an unsafe state, which means we hold the thread up. The rest of the threads can finish, which will mean eventually we'll have enough resources that we can give to this one thread, so they won't be blocked forever.
Okay, but, oh,
That's why we have this max. Every thread has to give what its max allocation might be.
So this isn't like just a simple thing, you know, you put some crossing after. You have to like implement this sort of max thing and all that stuff, right?
That's right. So the code actually has to declare its maximum allocation up front. Each thread has to say what's the maximum resources. That's correct. Right? Limitations, right? I mean, you can start to see why a lot of operating systems choose to ignore deadlocks, right? Because preventing them can get complicated. Undoing them once they've been detected also can be complicated. So oftentimes it's like, oh, we'll just assume they'll Control-Alt-Delete and reset the thing when it's dead, right? All right. We also started talking about scheduling, okay? And what was scheduling? Scheduling was sort of selecting the next process to run. Okay, now we did say you could schedule all sorts of wait queues as well, but mostly we talked about the ready queue. And we talked about first come, first serve scheduling or FIFO scheduling. Those are often used interchangeably. And the idea there is that you run each thread you pull off, you run it until it hits an IO operation. Then you go on to the next one and you run them all in order. And the upside of this, of course, is it's very simple. The downside is that the short jobs can often get stuck behind long ones. It's the luck of the draw. Are you unlucky enough? Okay. The one thing I will point out about first come, first serve scheduling is since it doesn't switch a lot, it's actually the most efficient from the standpoint of throughput, computational throughput. Because you basically let things run and they get all their cache state. They don't waste any time switching, etc. So it's the most efficient. It just doesn't necessarily have the responsiveness properties we might want from a system. Then we talked about round-robin scheduling, which is giving each thread a little chunk of time, and we just sort of work our way through all the threads, okay? First one, second one, third one, fourth one, come back, first one, second one, third one, fourth one. And this is usually driven by what we said was a quanta value, which is kind of how many milliseconds you run before you interrupt the thread. And the pros for this was it's great for short jobs because they know that they're not going to get stuck behind a long job, okay? Because we can bound the amount of time that you'll have to wait. The cons are that when the jobs are the same length, you end up with the worst combination of all of the parameters. So you get the longest average wait time. You get the longest average completion time. You also waste time switching. So round robin has its downside if you happen to have a whole set of identical jobs. But usually we don't run in that mode. Usually we have a mix of jobs, and we want to be able to somehow make sure the short ones go while giving CPU cycles to the long ones eventually. All right? Okay, and then we, of course, showed this, which was our example of what happens if we sort of have this set of jobs. We've got four jobs. One's eight units long, 24 units, 53 units, 68 units. And we can see that the best first come, first serve kind of has the following wait times here, where P2, being the shortest one, gets to go right away. That's the ideal. And then the worst one, of course, is if P2, the short job, is stuck to behind everybody else, and that's the longest case. And then various quanta for switching in between here. Now, how did I figure this out? Well, I sat down with some paper and drew it out and figured out what the switching was. Okay, so for humans to decide what's in the middle here is painful, which is, of course, why we have computers do it. It's not to say we might not make you figure that out in a test once or twice, but you might want to figure out how to get these numbers. But the important, interesting thing here is that the short job, namely P2, has the most to gain or lose by scheduling, because notice its variation here from wait time is from 0 to 145 or from 8 to 153 in completion time. And the long job kind of doesn't care so much. Okay, there are some anomalies here where the long job gets to go right away and isn't that great, but by and large, the long job takes a long time. And so usually our responsiveness is all about giving the short jobs cycles when they need them and let the long jobs run the rest of the time. Okay? Are there any questions on that? Good. All right. So today we want to finish our discussion of scheduling, and then we're going to start talking about implementation of address spaces and a few other things. Okay. So, and last time, just at the very end, we were starting to ask ourselves, what if we knew the future? And the reason we asked that question, of course, was if you look at this scenario, if we knew the future and could somehow know exactly how long P2 was, maybe we would want to run it first. If we knew the future. Okay, now, of course, the problem with that is that knowing the future is difficult, right? Think of all those people that would love to have sold all of their stocks last week. Or 2 weeks ago before this mess happens, right? So if we knew the future, then we suddenly have a couple of options here. We've got the shortest job first and the shortest remaining time first, which are basically simple variations of each other. I'm going to talk about this second one. But the idea there is at every point in time, you take a look and you ask yourselves, well, I know the future. Which of the things on my ready queue are going to run the least amount of time? Okay, pick that one. Run it. Now look at the next one. Run it. Now look at the next one. Run it. Okay, that's using our crystal ball. And the only difference kind of between these two options is in the second one, we allow interruptions to come in. So if a new job were to show up, we would also look at the new job right away and potentially interrupt somebody running. So we're always running the shortest remaining thing. Okay? And, of course, this, you can think of this as the whole program or bursts. Mostly we've been talking about program bursts in this class, which is sort of the amount of code or amount of number of instructions I need to run up to the next I.O. And what this does is, assuming we can predict the future, which we'll have to talk a little bit about today, what's great is we get the short jobs out of the system. So the short jobs get their responsiveness. We get short waiting times and short average completion times. And so they're the ones that have the most to gain, right? I showed you that earlier. The short jobs have the most to gain. The long ones, by and large, don't care much. Okay, and that's kind of the philosophy here. And these are, by the way, these are provably optimal. Okay, you could show that this is the optimal scheduling policy if what we want to do is minimize our average wait time or average completion time. Okay, any questions on these? Started talking about this last time, so okay. So I said they're provably optimal. I already said that. What about comparing shortest remaining time first with FCFS and round robin? Well, if all the jobs are the same length, then what happens? Well, shortest remaining time first actually just does FIFO or FCFS, right? Because if they're all the same length, you start running one of them. Now suddenly it's the shortest one, so it's going to run to completion. Now you get the next one. Okay, well, now it's the shortest one. It's going to run to completion. So shortest remaining time first actually just degenerates smoothly into FIFO, or first come, first serve, when they're all the same length. And if the jobs have varying lengths, then what happens is shortest remaining time first kind of pulls out the short one and reorders things so the short one runs first. Now, you could kind of say that's what round robin does, sort of, right? What it does is it keeps doing slices from all the jobs, which means the shortest one gets to finish first, kind of. Okay, maybe I'm warping that a little bit, but you can kind of see that idea. And shortest remaining time first is kind of the embodiment of the best version that a round robin might do. Okay, although it's a little better than round robin because there's not as much switching time, right? And so are there any questions on this? And I'm going to show you an example where we can kind of see how this how these really play out. Yeah, question.
How does it measure that how long is how does it measure the remaining time?
How does it measure the remaining time? Magic. Well, that's the predicting the future part, right? You have to suspend your disbelief for a moment that I can predict the future, and then we'll talk a bit about how, okay? Now, that's a great question, right? I haven't told you how to predict the future yet, right? But we'll come up with that. Let's assume magical mechanism does the trick, okay? So let's suppose that we have our little bit of magic there. So here's a couple of interesting jobs. We have jobs A and B are just really long. They run for a week. Okay? C is this I.O. bound job. You could think of this as, some sort of video player or something. What it does is it does a millisecond of compute and then 9 milliseconds of disk I.O. and then a millisecond of compute and so on. So what it's doing is it's pulling blocks off the disk and displaying them on your screen or something. Okay? Now, if we only have one at a time, C uses 90% of the disk, and A and B use 100% of the CPU. All right? Everybody with me on that? Presumably A and B, we're going to say, use no disk in the way I've described them here. Now, if we have a FIFO ordering policy, hopefully you guys can see that that's a bad plan here, right? Because if A or B starts running, C is toast. Okay, so you can't compute pi and listen to your music at the same time. Okay, clearly a bad situation. Now, if we have round robin or shortest remaining time first, what happens? Well, let's do a timeline on this. So here, for instance, is an ordering where C gets to start out, and it does some I.O. I mean, it does some compute, then it starts its I.O., and meanwhile, A starts in there, runs for the rest of it for a time slice. Let's say we got 100 milliseconds, and then B runs for 100 milliseconds, then C runs for a millisecond, does its I.O., and so on. Okay, so here is a case of round robin with 100 millisecond time segment. Now, why do we not have 100 milliseconds of time for C here? Done, right? It only runs for 1 millisecond, then it finishes. So we get our 1 millisecond here, and then A runs for its full quanta of 100 milliseconds, B for 100 milliseconds, etc. Okay, and of course this I/O is happily overlapped here with A, but we don't really get nice continuous sound or video out of this. You can probably see that, right? Now, the disk utilization, if we were to compute here, is 4.5%. Okay, we get sort of 9 milliseconds out of 201 milliseconds, which is nowhere close to the 90% we were getting earlier. And if we assume that 90% is somehow a desirable full use of the disk, we're clearly not making it here. Okay. Now, how many of you guys have ever tried copying, say, a CD? You start it up and it's busy copying, and then you start something else up and suddenly the copying slows way down. Did anybody ever notice that before? Okay? Not that you'd ever be copying something illegally, of course. You'd be doing this under the full copyright protection laws and all that sort of stuff. But what's interesting about that is the disk is mostly, mostly it's the disk that's moving and the CPU's idle there. But somehow by putting something else in the way, you've screwed up the scheduling such that you don't get the full I.O. overlap. And here is a good example, right? If this were a disk copy, we're not getting full speed disk copy here. Okay? Now, if we had a 1 millisecond slice of time, then, maybe this is a little better, right? C runs for a millisecond, does some I.O., then A runs, then B runs, and A runs, and then C gets to run again, and so on. And the reason that C would come in here is suddenly it's off of its disk wait queue and back on the ready queue, so now it gets a chance to run. Now, what disk utilization are we likely to get out of this situation? How many people think we get 90% out of this? Okay, how many people think we don't quite get 90%? Okay, why not? So overhead might get in the way. Okay, what else? Well, this is a question of the detail of the scheduler. Do we know that when C is finally ready to go and it's put on the ready queue, it's the next thing to run? We don't. Maybe B runs first and then C, right? If it's sort of their FIFO ordered on the scheduler queue. So this actually maybe gives you about 90%, but there's a lot of overhead in here, a lot of wake-ups, and we're not even guaranteed to actually get our full 90% because the scheduling could be slightly off by one, plus or minus a little. Okay. Now, SRTF, on the other hand, looks like this, right? Because C runs for a millisecond, starts its I.O., then A starts running, then C gets put back on the ready queue, and suddenly it's the shortest thing around. So it runs. And then A is now clearly shorter than B because A's run for a little bit, right? So A is going to be running. So basically with SRTF, we kind of get what we might want as our ideal here. We get sort of our 90% disk utilization and the long jobs run in the background with the maximum efficiency. Okay, now the only thing you might dislike about this is maybe you started A and B and you know they're going to use up a week each, but you'd like to see some progress on each one, maybe. This policy is not giving it to you. Okay, because what it's doing is it's holding B off for a week. But it does have this nice high disk utilization. Questions? Yeah.
So there still has to be something basically interrupting and checking what is the shortest runtime. And then it's not like doing a full swap processes. It's just saying, oh, this guy's still the shortest line of running, so it's not quite as bad.
Yeah, I would say in the ideal, whatever ideal means here, SRTF actually only needs to make new scheduling decisions when something changes about the schedule queue, like a new job comes on, right? Because other than that, it just gets to keep running. Because it knows, if you think about it, once it's chosen something that's the shortest, it's running it, it's still going to be the shortest. So it's only when new things show up on the ready queue that something has to change.
So it's like interrupt-driven.
Yeah, it's kind of an interrupt-driven scenario here, yeah. Okay, questions? More questions? So what's interesting about this is you can clearly end up with a starvation scenario, right? Take A, all right, A's a week long, and suppose a whole bunch of one-hour jobs show up. And suppose those are showing up at once an hour or once every 50 minutes. They will always be shortest, and A will never run. Okay, so this particular ideal may not actually be ideal because it may starve out the background jobs entirely. Okay. Now, the other problem, of course, is how do you predict the future? So some systems actually have been designed in the past where when you submit the job, you say, well, this is going to take 5 minutes. Okay. Now, of course, the problem with that is, one, maybe the person lies. Ah, yeah, this one-week job's going to take 3 minutes. The other problem, of course, is that, I don't know about you, but even predicting how long a job's going to take is pretty impractical, right? It's not like I'm an expert at how long my job's going to take. Okay, unless I've been running it 1,000 times and tweaking it, maybe I can guess, well, yeah, it took 4 minutes last time and I got a little better. It's going to take 3 minutes and 57 seconds. All right, but that's just not the way things happen. So the bottom line is, of course, we can't know the future perfectly, but we're going to use SRTF as a yardstick here to measure things by, and it's optimal, which says we can't do anything better. And so now what we're going to do is we're going to see if we can approximate SRTF, which is get some of the prediction aspect into it, without maybe being able to perfectly predict the future. Okay? So what are some pros and cons with SRTF? Pro, optimal, always good. Con, requires that whole predicting the future thing. Okay. Other con, it's unfair. We just showed you that it can starve out jobs. Okay. Now, so what about predicting? Well, one thing we can do is we can build an adaptive policy. An adaptive policy would be one that observes what is happening and adjusts what we're doing in response. Okay, And there are many cases of adaptive policies out there. This happens all the time, and you know, every conference somebody proposes a new adaptive policy. And where this particularly might be useful is if the program does a lot of I/O, so it's doing a lot of short bursts, then maybe we get enough data to get a good handle on how long a burst is. Think of that disk case, right? The disk program I showed you earlier, C, 1 millisecond, 9 milliseconds, 1 millisecond, 9 milliseconds, 1 millisecond, 9 milliseconds. You don't need a lot of data to figure out exactly how that sucker is going to behave, right? And of course, the thing is that if computer behavior were completely random, obviously we wouldn't be able to predict it, but fortunately computer behavior is not too random. Okay? So here's an example. Maybe we actually estimate the burst length, okay, like by using an estimator. Okay, I don't know how many of you have seen sort of an estimator which takes a bunch of times and kind of estimates the next time, or takes a bunch of values and estimates the next. Okay, and there's a whole, and you can actually take whole classes over here in this side of the tracks here on Kalman filters and different estimators. A very simple one is actually this exponential averaging idea, where you sort of have your last prediction, you have some alpha which is less than 1, which is how much you sort of discount your last prediction and figure in the next prediction, and you could end up with something like this. So here's some actual values, and here's the predictor. Okay, so this is the simplest example of some sort of take some data and use it to predict the burst for the next time. Okay? Simplest possible predictor, right? This is a, you know, infinite response time filter that tends to track pretty well. Okay. How many people have seen that kind of filter? Probably seen it many times, right? 61 or 40 or 20, one of those classes. 20, yeah. Okay, so good. Now, what about a different way of predicting? Okay, so let's think about, let's back up here for a second. What was our point of introducing SRTF in the first place? Well, one, it's an optimal thing, but the other is that we would like the short bursts to get a chance to run first and the longer bursts to be put off to the side. And our reasoning was precisely because the short bursts tend to have a lot to do with users' perception. Is this thing behaving quickly? I type a keystroke. Does it appear on the screen in shorter than 12 minutes? Okay, so the short bursts are important, and the long bursts tend to represent things that are computing a lot, and we want to push them off. Okay, so this particular scheme here would very quickly figure out whether something's got a lot of short bursts or some long ones. A different technique which is used a lot is this notion of multi-level feedback scheduling. Okay, and what you do is you imagine a bunch of ready queues. Okay, so we've been talking about one ready queue, but suppose that there's a number of them, and each ready queue has associated with it some parameters. So this might be a round robin ready queue with a parameter of a quantum of 8. This might be a round robin queue with a quantum of 16. This might be a first come, first serve queue. And what we're going to do is we're going to dump new jobs in the top there and assume they're short. And if it turns out they're not short, they're going to slowly work their way down. So the long ones tend to fall down, and the short ones tend to go back up again. So every time you sort of restart, you're up here. Or if you run and you end shorter than your quantum, you typically go up a level. So the short ones filter up, the long ones filter down. Okay, and this is actually another way of exploiting past behavior. Why? Because the past behavior ends up coded in where I am, which of the scheduling queues I'm in. Okay, and you could think of this as multiple queues with different priorities. So the higher priority ones get to run with preference over the lower priority ones. Every queue has its own scheduling algorithm. So I mentioned round robin and first come, first serve here. Each one might have a different quantum. So when you're in the short queue realm, you get switched quickly. And as you sort of start becoming more and more background and longer running, your quantum becomes longer. And then eventually, you don't get switched at all. And this particular technique is used in a lot of schedulers. So a lot of Unix schedulers and Windows schedulers have this kind of behavior to them. And you could think of this as a loose way of trying to approximate shortest remaining time first. Okay, why is that? Well, because we try to segregate the short ones from the long ones, and that gives us, you know, some ability to run the shortest ones first. Okay? So what are some details? So this is sort of an approximated SRTF. CPU-bound jobs kind of drop like a rock. I/O-bound jobs stay near the top. And you have to schedule somehow between the queues. So one option would be fixed priority scheduling, so you always run the ones in the top queue first and the next and so on. The other might be time slicing, so you give the top queue 70% of the CPU and the next one 20% and the next one 10%. These are all different options you could come up with. And of course, what's kind of amusing about this is because of the prevalence of these queues, people have figured out how to approximate this. So there was a rather amusing computer game contest that was run 15 years ago when some of these first started showing up. I think it was an Othello game. Everybody got to play their Othello games against each other. And what people figured out was that if they somehow got short bursts, they would get more CPU time. And so what they did was they would also put a bunch of meaningless IOs like printfs in their compute loop, and as a result, they would end up with bursty-looking behavior. They would filter to the top, and they'd get more CPU time. So this is an example of knowing the type of schedule you've got and actually exploiting that in some way. Okay? So what does that mean? Well, that means any scheduler you come up with, if somebody knows it in sufficient detail, they might be able to come up with a way of scamming it. And the interesting question there then becomes, how much do you trust your users and how much don't you trust your users? What's the biggest example of not trusting a job running today? Now, 20 years ago, we had a bunch of people sharing a machine. Obviously, you got to be careful because some people might be malicious, others might not. Today, remember I mentioned how rather than number of people per machine, we have number of machines per people, right? We're in that reverse case. What do we have to worry about today that's of a similar issue, similar sort of flavor? Yeah. Spyware, viruses, malicious code of other sorts. Okay, so unfortunately, these issues of malicious code has only gotten worse over the years. So what do we do? I don't know. What would be a countermeasure to the countermeasure for the Othello program? I don't know. You'd have to figure out it's doing meaningless I/O and demote it. I don't know. Think about that. I mean, how do you do that, right? It's tricky. All right, so some administrivia. Midterm one's coming up, okay, next week, Wednesday. I did manage to get rooms, although we're split, so kind of half of you is going to be in one room and half in the other. But it will be 5:30, 8:30, and it'll be a two-hour exam with extra time, and you get one, so it's a three-hour exam, obviously. You get one page of handwritten notes, both sides. Okay, no books, no cell phones, no laptops, etc. No cans with cords between them, etc. No class that day, so next Wednesday, so that's a week from this Wednesday, we won't be having class. I'll be having extended office hours. You guys can come by. We'll make sure the TAs post a little extra time as well, so that you can ask questions. Yeah.
Did you have a discussion that day? There's still discussion?
Yes, still discussion on the day of the midterm. Because Tuesday and Wednesday discussions will, there might be interesting things to have them that they'll say. So.
Okay.
Good question, though. We're going to have a review session as well. So Sunday before 10:12, I guess that's next Sunday, 7 p.m. Soda Hall. TAs will be handling that. Come with your questions. Because if you don't ask questions, then they'll put up some things they think that you want to know about. But who knows? I mean, if you come with the things you actually want to know about, then you know you'll get the best review session. But anyway, come. You can also listen in to other people's questions as well. Okay. Topics, everything up to and including next Monday, which basically we're going to be history, concurrency, multithreading, synchronization, protection, address spaces. That's pretty much topics. Any other questions about this? Now, there's one trickiness here, which I will bring up, which is that your design document for project number 2 is actually due next Monday. Unfortunately, because we sort of have projects every 3 weeks, things get a little crammed around the exams. I apologize about that. That's just kind of the way it ends up. Design reviews, we're going to try to do them Tuesday and Wednesday. Okay, now realize for each of you guys, I know that we had some long design reviews last time, but that's not how they're supposed to be. They're supposed to be like a 25-minute thing, so we're going to limit them to the time they're supposed to be. But anyway, so Tuesday or Wednesday are going to be the design reviews. So that'll be 1 half hour out of your day. And you should talk to your TAs this week. They're going to try to make sure that we've got times that work for everybody. So next week, unfortunately, is a crunch week. And I apologize, but then the following week will be great. Sorry about that. We just kind of the perfect storm of due dates kind of showed up. Okay. It's better to get the design documents done earlier rather than later to see what your misthinking might be. So that's why I try to keep them going as regular as clockwork. Okay, there are no other questions. Okay, good. So what about fairness? Is it fair that all those deadlines are next week? I don't know. Is it fair that they were all scheduled next week? I don't know the answer to that. So let me just say a little bit about fairness and scheduling, not having to do with class, but rather the actual computer scheduling. So strictly priority scheduling, kind of like you guys did for the last project, is somewhat unfair, right? Because if you always have higher priority jobs, then lower priority ones may never get to run. And there actually are some, it's probably urban myth, but Multics, that machine that I told you that was the grandfather of all OS complexity, when they finally shut down the machine, they actually found a 10-year-old job that had been sitting there and hadn't been making any progress. Now you kind of have to ask why nobody noticed the job or why nobody noticed they weren't getting their answer out. But anyway, this is a doesn't happen too often, but this is an example of why priority scheduling may be a problem. So what do you do about this? Well, you clearly must give some fraction of the CPU to the low priority jobs just to make sure that they make some progress. Okay? And you got to realize that there's a trade-off here because fairness, in some sense, is gained by hurting average response time. Because one of the reasons we might have something like an SRTF policy is so that we can make sure that the short jobs always get to run. And the reason we want to do that is so that users are happy and they're seeing good response time. By giving a little bit of the CPU to the lower priority, longer jobs, we're breaking that philosophy a bit. Okay, so we're losing some of our average response time in order to gain fairness. It's just kind of where it's at. Now, what's going to be interesting as ManyCore really shows up, and we get 80 cores on your laptop or 100 cores, Now it will be about how many CPUs do you allocate to given jobs? And again, we'll probably run into the same thing. There will be some low priority things you want to make sure get at least one CPU for a little while. Right? So these kind of ideas filter over to that domain. So how do we implement fairness? Well, we could give, as I mentioned in the multi-level scheduler, we could give every queue some fraction of the CPU. Okay, so if we had one long-running job and 100 short-running ones, then what? Well, if you try to give some good chunk of CPU to the short-running ones and there's 100 of them, there may not be a lot of CPU left to even give a little to the long one. So there is a little bit of an issue here. The analogy here, of course, is the so-called five items or less line that you see at the supermarket, right? And you got a line of 20 people from it, right? Well, maybe you might as well wait behind the person with 12 pot roasts and three gallons of milk. You know, might be faster. So one option which is often used, but it's very ad hoc in Unix and a few variants of Unix, is you notice jobs that have never gotten any CPU time, and you give them higher priority a little bit. You increment their priority. Okay? And of course, the reason this is so ad hoc is how fast you increment their priority. I don't know. Eventually, of course, as the system gets overloaded, in some sense, no job gets CPU time, everybody increases priority, and now you've got sort of FIFO or something, and you've got no interaction. So I don't know. What you can see here is if the number of jobs relative to the number of CPUs is too high, you've got bad performance anyway. I mean, that's ultimately going to happen. Nobody's going to be happy. Now, one idea which you get to implement in phase two here is the lottery scheduler. This is kind of a fun alternative scheduling idea, and it's based on the lottery. So the idea is that jobs are given a number of lottery tickets, and the scheduler chooses lottery numbers randomly, and at each time phase, the one who wins gets some CPU time. Okay? So what you can see here is somehow the CPU time ends up being proportional to the number of tickets. You give somebody a lot of tickets, they have a lot of chances to win. If they have a small number of tickets, they get fewer chances to win. Okay? So how do you assign tickets? Well, to get something like SRTF, you imagine you give more tickets to the short jobs and less tickets to the longer jobs. To avoid starvation, maybe every job gets at least one ticket. Assuming your random number generator is fair, what it means is that eventually every job gets a little CPU time as long as they have at least one ticket. Okay, and the advantage over strict priority scheduling, this behaves gracefully as the load changes. So as you add more jobs in, what happens is everybody still gets some CPU time because everybody still has some number of tickets, one even. They'll just get a smaller fraction. All right? I can give you some examples here which might help. So assume we've got short jobs get 10 tickets, long jobs get one ticket. This is purely an example. If we have sort of one short job and one long job, what happens? Well, the short job gets 91% of the CPU. The long job gets 9%. See how that works? We got 11 total tickets, right? 10 out of 11 is 91%. 1 out of 11 is 9%. Okay? And then you could see a few other options here, like if we have 10 short jobs and one long job, the short jobs each get 9% and the long job gets 0.99%. If we have sort of one short job, 10 long jobs, short ones get 50%, the long ones get 5%. So what's kind of nice about this, even though the absolute numbers may or may not be what you'd want, you can see how the short jobs in this case are still getting the bulk of the CPU and the long ones are getting less CPU. So that's sort of like SRTF. Sort of. Okay, and that's why the lottery scheduler is interesting from that standpoint. You know, and if, of course, there's so many short jobs that you get no response time, one approach might be actually log your user out or kill off some jobs. OK? Okay, and we're actually going to talk about thrashing in virtual memory systems maybe next week. And there is a situation where, again, oversubscribing of resources, the best thing to do is to stop some use of the resources, like stop a job for a while, let the other ones complete, and then start the job is more likely to get you good efficiency than trying to let everybody share the resources at once. Okay? Any questions on the lottery scheduler? Yeah. No, when you win the lottery, you get a time quanta. So there's still a quanta involved here. Then you get put back on the resource queue with your ticket again, and you'll get, next time, you'll get randomly picked. You get to run again. So the simplest way to think of this is the tickets are numbered from 1 to N, whatever N is, and everybody just holds on to their number. And there's somebody randomly working this through a random sequence, and eventually it'll get back to that number to give you more time again. Another question, yeah?
How's the priority scheduler?
Well, the difference with the priority scheduler is that high priority jobs get to run at the exclusively over the low priority ones, whereas this, even the low priority ones, in some sense, are the ones with smaller number of tickets that get to run. That make sense? So the problem with a priority scheduler is that it's got starvation. You can't guarantee that the lower background ones run. Good. Any other questions? Okay, so let's close out scheduling just a little bit, and then we'll take our break. So how do we evaluate a scheduling algorithm? Well, one option would be we could somehow do some mathematics, right? We sort of pre-compute based on the way that the scheduler has been formulated and some predetermined workload what our result is going to be. This is, in general, very hard to do well because, as you can imagine, schedulers are extremely complicated. And they don't lend themselves well to mathematical description. Okay? Another option might be some sort of queuing theory, which might help if you could somehow predict how often the threads are in, you know, the high priority queue, the next priority queue, so on. That also can be done, but can be very complicated. A more general way of sort of implementing is with a simulator. And the idea here is that you got a bunch of actual threads and you kind of simulate their CPU cycles and you run them through a simulator with different schedulers in them, and you can kind of figure out how much CPU they get and how much progress they make. Okay, and the simulator, how many people have ever written or used a simulator of some sort, any sort? Okay, the nice thing about simulators is they don't have to have all the details of reality in them. So you could imagine that you know, basically all you did was had something that sort of said that the threads had X number of CPU cycles followed by X number of I/O cycles, and you could run them through the simulator, and you don't actually have to run the threads. You don't have to compute all their values, but you could still find out about the scheduler. So oftentimes simulators have the minimum level of detail required to get the answers you want. And that could be much less detailed than building a whole operating system, putting a scheduler in, running code on it, and seeing what happens. Okay? So when do the details of the scheduling policy really matter? When there aren't enough resources. Okay? I've said a couple of times throughout this class that the OS is all about scheduling resources. A lot of the OS is about scheduling resources. Time, memory, I/O, et cetera, et cetera. When there aren't enough resources, then it really matters how the scheduling policy works. If you've only got one thing running, you don't care what the scheduling policy is because it's running. Okay? If you got 1,000 things running, you might really care what the scheduling policy is. Okay? When should you just not try to get a better scheduler, but just buy a faster computer or a better network link or an expanded highway? Well, I buy it when it'll pay for itself and improve resources, okay? So there are times when you're just trying to do too much with one machine and no scheduling algorithm is going to help you, and the best thing to do is to buy a new computer. Okay, now I'm not saying this from the standpoint of the computer industry. Hi, I work for Dell. You should buy a new computer. But when you think about it, if you're oversubscribing resources, one way to fix that is more resources. All right. And there is a curve here. We'll talk about queuing theory in general a little bit later in the term. But what's interesting to me is a lot of things in engineering have this response curve, where if you look at the utilization from 0 to 100%, as you increase utilization, the response time kind of goes up linearly for a while. So, you know, you put two jobs together and things are, you know, twice as slow, and three jobs three times as slow. This is all seems fine. And suddenly, as you start getting closer and closer to 100% utilization, the curve takes off very non-linearly. Okay, this is a queuing phenomenon. Okay, and almost everything that you design as an engineer will run up into this, problem. And of course, the simple answer here is never ever design something that uses 100% of any resource, because you're likely to be in the badly performing zone. Okay, and if you're building bridges and you're at the 100% load bearing part of the bridge, that's probably very bad as well, because this represents fatigue and possible failure. So keep that in mind, and we'll actually look at some simple queuing models later when we get into disks. And show you where at least one instance of this comes from. This is a general phenomenon, all right? And most scheduling algorithms that we talked about up till now work really well as long as you're in the linear region. But once you hit this knee, none of them perform very well. Okay, it's just kind of picking the best of possible worst options, okay? And that's the point at which new resources are needed. All right, I think we are ready to take a break. Let's take about 3 minutes. I've actually managed to break earlier today. I apologize to those of you that asked me to do that before and I hadn't succeeded. We'll come back about 3 minutes and continue.
That's okay. In fact, I don't think the evaluations actually work. Do they work? Yeah, don't worry about it. I'll see you guys do that on Wednesday, because I think somebody else will have trouble doing it. Thank you. auto-grader results before the reports are graded, because that we can do automatically, but we're having a little bit of trouble getting readers to grade the reports. So if you know anybody who's taken this class before that would want to be a reader, we'd love to hear from them. Well, it's a combination of the reader and the TA.
Okay, welcome back. I will actually put out this plug. If you, we are a little bit short on readers this term for some reason. If you know anybody who's taken this class before and would like to be a reader, I can still use one or two of them. So have them contact me like yesterday if you know anybody who took this class before. So, all right. So let's change gears now. Let's talk about those resources in general. We've been talking about CPU resources, but let's talk about general resources. And kind of the physical reality here is that different processes or threads share the CPU, the memory, the I/O devices, et cetera, et cetera. And in order to provide a smoothly functioning system, we have to somehow share those resources in a way that is kind of a clean interface between each processor thread in the system. And we've sort of talked about this idea of virtualizing, which is present an interface to the processes or threads that looks like they have 100% access to their resources, even though we know that somebody underneath is multiplexing them somehow. Okay? And today we're going to start talking about memory sharing. And why worry about sharing of memory? Well, the reason is the complete working state of a process or the kernel or whatever is the data in its memory and the data in the registers. So that actually is a pretty important part of a computation. And we can't just let different threads kind of use the same memory. Right? There's this kind of amusing physics problem that if you sort of try to shove two different things into the same register, they don't fit, right? Okay, two things can't be in the same place at once. Actually, if we end up talking about, if people convince me to talk about quantum computing at the end of the term, I will change my tone on that a little bit, but that's another story. But we probably don't want different threads to even have access to the same memory under most circumstances for protection reasons, right? We've already talked about that. Okay? So here, if you recall, this is a diagram from earlier in the term where we sort of talked about what is a process. And a process is kind of an address space, which is a hard boundary, and one or more threads, right? So the threads encapsulate the concurrency or active component, and the address space encapsulates the protection component. And the simplest view is it keeps a buggy program from trashing the rest of the system. Okay, but the address space boundaries are the passive part of the process. So what's some important aspects of memory multiplexing that we might have to worry about? One is controlled overlap. So the state of different threads should not collide in memory. Okay, and we want to be controlled about avoiding overlap when we don't want it. And, of course, we want to allow overlap occasionally for communication. So we need to control the overlap. A second part is translation. So we want to be able to translate accesses from one address space to the other. Okay, and when a translation exists, processor uses virtual addresses, physical memory uses physical addresses, and the translation gets you from one to the other. And the nice side effects of translation is you can use it to avoid overlap by translating to different places, and you can use it to give a uniform view of memory, like everybody gets an address zero. And I'll show you both of these in a second. And then, of course, there's the protection angle, which is prevent access to private memory. So your private memory gets protected from other processes. Okay, and you can also, because of protection, often give different behavior to different pages. Like some pages can be read-only. If you try to write them, a fault occurs. Some pages are protected, okay, so that only the kernel gets to mess with them, etc. Programs might be protected from themselves. So before we kind of go into translation mechanisms, let's look at something very simple here, which you've probably all realized from your 61 classes, but let's see if I can remind you. So let's talk about binding of instructions and data to actual addresses. So what is this process? The process is choosing addresses for instructions from the standpoint of the processor. So here is some assembly code, for instance. For instance, we might have a data region here that's at some address that has 32 words in it. We have some code that has a label start, loads some data out of the data region, jumps to the check it subroutine, which then we return back. It adds something to the loop. It loops a little bit, et cetera. This is what a programmer might write. But this doesn't actually tell you where these instructions are in memory, right? This is a virtualized set of instructions. And somebody has to turn it into bits. Okay? So here's an example of one possible set of bits where, for instance, maybe this data segment starts at address hex 300, and it's got a 20 hex in it. And maybe this load word, so we're translating into MIPS, by the way, is an 8C20. And the lower offset, 00C0, is actually a pointer to this address. And maybe this jump and link is a 0C followed by this 00340, which turns out happens to be the address of where that subroutine is, et cetera. So part of the compiling and linking process is turning this human-readable stuff into a set of bits that's actually executable by the CPU. And in the process of doing that translation, their choices have to be made, like the fact that we actually put this data segment at hex 300, or right, the fact that we put this loop here at hex 900, or this subroutine at hex D00. Okay, those choices were made. Now, can we put them elsewhere? Sure. Okay, we could rearrange things. In fact, there's the optimizations that people do to optimize cache misbehavior where they rearrange the loops and so on. So you could rearrange the code. When do you do that? Right? You could do it in the compiler. You could do it at load time. You could do it at execution time, et cetera. Lots of choices. Okay? And, of course, the related question here is sort of which physical memory location hold particular instructions or data. Now, if we had a really simplistic early processor, microprocessor, maybe these are the actual DRAM addresses. No translation. They come out of the processor. This is where they are in DRAM. If we've got something more sophisticated, maybe these are just virtual addresses, and somewhere else we make a decision about what physical data, where to put it physically in DRAM. Okay, so there's a lot of placement choices here. Are there any questions in this process? They've all taken you through assembly language to binary at some point in your career, right? And you know, obviously the details change, which this is MIPS, but the details change with every processor and so on. And no, you're not going to be tested on this. So if you were to actually check the what happens when you get from a starting source program to something that runs, it's actually a lot of stuff. So you write this source program. It maybe gets compiled by a compiler and assembler to produce object modules, and a bunch of those get linked together to produce a load module. Okay, and those load modules might be loaded together with system libraries to give a sort of a binary image that can actually be executed. And even after it starts running, you may end up linking in dynamic libraries. Okay, so for instance, addresses of where in memory things are going to be placed actually could happen anywhere, in the compiler, the loader, the linker, or dynamically at runtime. I don't know how much you know about dynamic libraries, but they're always kind of an interesting idea here. So there are actually some library functions that are already preloaded in memory, and your program starts running, and it doesn't actually know where these things are in memory. And it's the act of sort of executing the first call that causes a dynamic linking operation to happen, where the stub actually gets replaced by the physical address of where that thing was. So there's a case where parts of the program aren't even known until you start executing. It's called dynamic linking. Okay. So what's the point of this? The bottom line here is that going from what you as a programmer see to the physical locations of the code is a potentially very complicated process, sometimes only resolving it at link time, sometimes only resolving at execution time. Okay, questions? Now, since things can be deferred so long, can we use this placement of data to help us multi-thread? That's going to be our first question. Okay? So before we go that far, let's see what happens if we have no translation or protection. Welcome to MS-DOS land. And this is a case where applications always run at the same place in physical memory, and applications have full access to everything. So we might actually look at this. Here's a 32-bit address space from 0 to 4 gigabytes. And application is somewhere in there, the operating system somewhere. And the application is given the illusion that it's got a dedicated machine because it's got a dedicated machine. Okay, there's no need for an illusion here. Okay, and this is, incidentally, MS-DOS. Okay, it's not very sophisticated. When you produce a program and you get a .com or a .exe, all the decisions have already been made at exactly what addresses everything is going to be laid out at. Okay? It's all made up front. Of course, this doesn't really help us have two things happening at once. So what if we want two things? Well, suppose we don't have any translation or protection, but we still want two programs loaded in memory at the same time. What can we do? We have no translation or protection. How do we get two programs loaded at the same place or at the same time? What was that?
By convention.
What do you mean by convention?
We just, you know, some processes that just make a promise that use
Oh, I see. So, yeah, different processes promise to only use a certain part of the address space. Okay, that's certainly part of it. They have to be non-malicious. That's right. What else? What about their addresses that are actually in the code? What is that? What has to be true there? Yeah.
You have to translate them.
That's right. They have to be non-overlapping. Right? So even if we've got two identical applications, we're going to have a situation where some of them have addresses starting at 0 and the other at, say, 20,000 hex. Okay? This is a case where we've actually translated the code either at compile time or, more likely, as was said here, at load time. When we load it in, we translate all the addresses so that the code that's up here kind of works and the code that's down here works. Okay, and you know, remember how we had that data segment that was at 300 hex? Well, maybe it's at 300 hex here, but it's going to be at, you know, 20,300 hex up here. So depending on where you load this thing in memory, it's going to have different addresses in the actual binary. Okay? But we can do that, because we can do this at load time. Okay? Now, of course, there's no protection here, right? So if either one of these guys screws up, it crashes the whole machine. Now, suppose we want to have at least a little bit of protection. Okay, what might we do? What's the simplest thing we could do? Yeah. So run the OS separate from the application. So what does that mean? Oh, okay. So have somehow kernel space and user space so that parts of the system are only readable and writable by the kernel or the user. Okay, so that's actually already more sophisticated than what I was thinking. What else could we do? Suppose we have this application and it's busy running away and it tries to access memory down here. Should we allow that? Maybe not. Or suppose it tries to access memory in the operating system. Should we allow that? Yeah, we could do some sort of segmentation where we say this application's only allowed this range of addresses, no more. Talking pretty primitive here, but it seems like it could work, right? So here's an idea where what we do is we have two new registers, a base register and a limit register. The base register kind of tells us where we're starting from, and the limit is kind of how many words we've got. Okay? Or this could be a limit address, in which case maybe this is 30,000 hex. okay? And if the user tries to access an illegal address, what we do is we cause an error. Okay? And so during the switch, what happens is the kernel loads a new base limit for the thread that it's going to let run. And so all that's happening is we keep altering these guys, okay, as we switch. So here's some hardware. Okay, so the CPU has some addresses that come out. Maybe we add a base to it, giving us physical addresses, and we check for the limit. Okay? Now, I actually pulled a fast one on you here because the question is, when we're running a given, suppose we're running that thread that's at 20,000 hex, does the address that come out of here, is that 20,000 hex or is it zero? Notice what I've done here. I've taken my addresses and I've added a base to them. So in this scenario, if we had this special hardware, all we do is we load the application as if it were at zero, but we put it at 20,000 hex. And now the addresses that come out of here are going to get automatically translated to physical ones. This was actually something that was available in the original Cray 1, all right? And obviously, if they pick something that's too high, we give them an error. Okay, and that means that if they're outside their range or they try to use a negative, an address that's negative or whatever, they basically aren't allowed to do it. And it's got the nice upside that our loader no longer has to figure out where it's physically loaded. It can load as if it's always loading from zero. So what we've effectively done here is we've given every thread that's running its own zero. Okay? And if you think about the x86, which everybody probably has used many times in their life, what it actually has is many segments where when you do a loader store, you actually specify the segment as part of the loader store. And that effectively tells you what base limit pair you're going to use when you're using that segment. So you can actually have more than one of these things. Okay? Yeah, question?
So that's what the segmentation fault is? You're in someone else's segment?
Yeah, so a segmentation fault that specifies a particular segment in that case is telling you that you are trying to do an access in that segment and you ran outside of your limits. Okay? And the virtual addresses, by the way, the funny thing about that is that there's many zeros in that sense, then one for each segment. And you sort of, you know, you get a zero for every segment. It's a way to think of that as well. Okay. So this provides a level of indirection. So this is kind of a start. Operating system can actually move bits around behind your back. So remember, if we loaded, if we had no segmentation and we loaded things here, such that they would run properly at 20,000 hex, then we could not just pick this thing up and move it because suddenly the code wouldn't work. So we're not allowed anymore as the kernel to move things underneath without reloading things, okay, which is a pain. Whereas with this, we can actually move them around. Okay, and of course, obviously, only the operating system should be allowed to change the base and limit. Make sense to everybody? Obviously, if we allow user programs to change their base and limit, we get chaos out of that. What do we save and restore in a context switch? Well, kind of everything we did before plus the base and limit values. Okay? Or we could, for instance, put the whole thing out to disk and bring it back in later. That would be called swapping. Okay? So we could actually save. We could say, oh, here's its segment. Let's just take this whole thing, put it out, bring it back later, and start running again. We're not talking that yet, but we're going to get there soon. What's the hardware cost? Well, this is simple. Two registers, kind of an adder and a comparator. Slows the hardware down a little bit because you have to do that addition, but all right, not too bad. And if you want really simple protection, this is a really cheap way to get it, and this is something that shows up in some embedded processors. It's very simple. Okay? Can anybody tell me what a pretty clear downside of this technique is? if this is your only translation. Imagine, yeah, go ahead.
Actually, I have a question.
Sure, go ahead. Ask your question.
Well, the answer, I think, would be every segment being a small segment.
Yeah, the downside here is that each segment has to have a contiguous chunk of memory. And why is that a downside?
Because if you load it, you have memory, you have fragmentation.
Fragmentation, great. Okay. Yes, and I'll show you that in the next slide here. That's the problem here, fragmentation. So what's your question?
My question was, I assume that modern operating systems have ESXi and stuff, right? So,
yeah, well, that's going to be what we use next year.
So, but why is this the most segmentation?
The reason things are still called segmentation faults is because the notion of segments, you sort of have regions you're supposed to be touching and regions you're not. And so when you're outside of it, you're outside of the text segment or the data segment. So even when you've got pages, there typically you talk about segments of contiguous segments. That's a good question. It's sort of old terminology why segmentation fault still shows up. So here's the fragmentation problem, obviously. So here we have a very happy situation where we've got some processes loaded, and then process two exits. So then we got that big chunk. Then process 9 comes in, we sort of put it in there, and then process 10 comes in. And of course the problem here is that, say process 9 now exits, we're going to have these weird holes all over the place. And so we're going to spend all our time copying to sort of free up space in order to allow new processes to start. Okay, so this seems like a rather primitive and not too desirable idea. And the other problem is this doesn't really allow the stack and the heap to grow very well. Okay. And it's really hard to do inter-process sharing, because if you only have one segment and all of them are not overlapping, then there's no way to share. Now that says maybe you have two segments, one of which is not intentionally overlapping. Okay, but this is kind of a crude technique. So what's the better idea? So here's a version 2. Okay, we're going to still run multiple applications in such a way that they're protected from one another. Goals are to isolate processes and kernel from one another, allow flexible translation, which doesn't give you fragmentation, gives you easy sharing, and allows only part of the process to actually be loaded at once. That's another problem, by the way, I didn't say here. This, as I've stated segmentation, I need to have all of process 2 loaded in order when it's working, because you either have it completely loaded or you don't. I haven't given you the ability to have some things loaded, okay? So some of the mechanisms that we need, a general address translation mechanism that basically can fit physical chunks of memory into arbitrary places in user space, not limited to a small number of segments, okay? So you could think of this as providing thousands of little segments, which we're going to call pages, which we're going to shove together to get the big segments that the user uses. Okay. And we're also going to need dual mode operation. So we're going to need something that allows us to easily protect our translation mechanism. That was clearly needed prior to this, and we'll talk about dual mode next time in a lot more detail. So here, you saw this already. Voila. Okay, remember this diagram? So here we have our translation tables, and the idea now is that the user's address space gets translated to a set of pages that are in DRAM. And these pages now are going to be all fixed size. So we're going to pick sizes for our pages that are 4K or 8K or 16K. Those are most common sizes. And so the code might actually have many pages here. This might be 12 pages. Okay, and we're going to be able to individually translate each one of them. Okay, and who's going to do that? An MMU. Okay, so this blue bubble here gets translated by some piece of hardware, which is going to take virtual addresses from the processor, turn them into physical addresses. Okay? And also for the kernel, it's also going to have the option of getting untranslated accesses. So we have kind of two views of memory now. We've got the physical view, which is what's in DRAM, and the virtual view, which is what our actual programs use. Okay? And translation is going to help us implement protection for exactly the reason we talked about already in this term. If two processes don't have translations that point to the same physical DRAM, then they're not going to have access to the same physical DRAM. Okay? Protection happens by lack of translation. Okay? So how does this work? Okay, we're going to talk about this in great detail next time, but here's an example of one way to do translation. This is a two-level page table. We have our actual address here, 32 bits, is divided into a 12-bit offset, so we're doing 4K pages. 10 bits of index, another 10 bits of index. And what we do, okay, is to translate this virtual address into a physical address, we take the first 10 bits, we look in the top level page table, that 10 bits selects one of 10 page table entries, or excuse me, one of 1,024 page table entries. That points at a second level page table. We take the next 10 bits, that selects one of 1,024 entries. That finally points to a page in memory. So when the processor produces this address, we go through this translation and we say, oh, that page address shows up at this page. And last but not least, these 12 bits get used to say which of the 4,096 bytes in this page actually get used. Okay? So we do two levels to pick the page, and then the offset selects within the page. Okay? And every user has a different page table. Okay, and how do we switch address spaces? We go from one process to another. We switch address spaces by simply switching the pointer to the top level page table, and voila, we have a brand new address space. Okay, we'll talk about this in much detail next time. So in conclusion, shortest job first. Run whatever job has the least amount of work to do. Con of that is need to predict the future. Multi-level feedback scheduling, very common. We talked about that. Multiple queues of different priorities. Short jobs float up. Long jobs fall down. Lottery scheduler. Everybody has a number of tickets and the amount of CPU time based on the tickets. Okay. Talked about memory sharing. Controlled overlap translation protection. Those are the things that we're going after here. We talked about segmentation, which is fine but is limited. We talked about using the MMU for full translation, and we'll talk about dual mode next time. We have a lot more to say about translation, but have a great couple of days. We'll see you on Wednesday.